getting information that they can then use to understand what fish are, and actually communicate with the regulators so they know what's happening while fish interacting with these devices as well. So how does this all fit together? And I really just want to give an example of crossing from the people to the devices to the fish, and how we're actually doing some cooperative research with the fishermen, and how we involve them in our research that we're doing in this group. And these are just some pictures from some of our work. And one of the big things working in these tightly dynamic areas as a researcher is we, as researchers, don't understand these environments as well as the fishermen do. So the first thing we did was to contact the fishermen in the area and say, how can we get this done? And so we've been working closely with the fishermen to conduct research, and that's kind of depicted by the picture on the left there. We've been working, and people know Butch Harris has been vital to our work. And I tried to find a picture of Butch, but he appears to always be facing away from the camera. So it's hard to depict that. But anyway, we've worked with several fishermen in the community to conduct our research. And the picture on the right is a trawl, somebody who's trawling with us to do our fish community work. So that's just one level of involving fishermen in our work. The other part that I mentioned is that we're trying to understand the people's perceptions of what we're doing in the community and getting their feelings on tidal power, and if we're asking the right questions from the fish perspective. The fishermen want to know what's happening in those areas, and they want to collect the right information to help them answer their questions. So one of the things we did in 2010 is go out and ask people, you know, what we asked them several different questions, but one of the things we heard is that we really need to go out and talk with people and get on the ground and be there to understand people's questions. So we've really, over the last couple of years, tried hard to work at these things. Again, boots on the ground is the best way. Be there to talk with people in coffee shops. And so we've really made an effort in our research to do this and to try to incorporate the people's understanding of the environment into our work. So to put that into perspective, this is kind of just a scientific method essentially, a circle. And a problem was identified to us by essentially the regulatory agencies. We need to understand. So what we did is we went to the people in Eastport who were the fishermen, and we said, well, you know this best. What is our best approach to this? So we took some of their input and actually incorporated it into our research design, and then incorporated their help into our research, and then went back to them and presented our results. And this is one lesson learned that I really wanted to convey today, is that it's one thing to work with fishermen in the community to do your research. The next step of that is bringing that information back. And we hear over and over again how appreciative the fishermen are that we've been going back over and over again to show them what we've been finding. And so it's really informative to them and gives them some information to move forward with. This is kind of one of the things that we've been learning, and we've been going back and meeting with fishermen over and over again so that they understand. Conducting surveys and trying to understand how people perceive not only tidal power, but the research that we're doing to try to answer the questions around power development in the community. So Chris also asked me what worked in some of our engagement work, and really one of the things that worked was Chris actually went around to fishermen's trucks and put notices saying when we'd be around doing our research. And I know that sounds very, time consuming, and I'm not sure it was, Chris, but people really appreciated the fact that you were there and telling them, we're going to be here, we're going to be doing work, and we're going to be in your area. And so really that was helpful to them. And really, what we heard back is at one of our community meetings, someone, we had interacted with a fisherman who thought we had done something maybe to his gear. And then we invited him to this meeting, and he really appreciated the fact that Chris went and put a notice in his truck. So hearing this back, being able to respond to it and work with the community in our research has really been really benefited being in the community and doing our research. So I'll stop there. I'm happy to answer questions, and especially if you have questions on the specific research we've been doing and some of the
You had a slide where you were going to show a modeling of what happened to the tides around that area, but I didn't see what was that. You didn't describe what was happening to the, what, how the rest of the tides were affected by.
It's really a localized effect where the devices are located, that you can actually see the flow dynamics around the devices changing. But it's really, it wasn't really a far field effect. And there's a lot more work going on that that needs to be refined.
So there's no, you don't see any immediate need to do monitoring it upstream or downstream or anywhere else besides very localized as far as environmental monitoring?
For the hydrodynamics?
Or just for what's happening with the fish or anything?
So, you know, the hydrodynamics are informing what we're doing on the fish work, but the fish work that we're, the data collection we're doing on the fish is not right only on the device. We're also doing collections for the device as well. So it's not as well integrated, in my hope. but we are doing, we're actually starting to do some work where we're collecting hydrodynamic data together with fish density data that will be correlated with each other.
And we are doing measurements to take wake and turbulence measurements for that.
Yeah, all the research I've read around the world and in North and South America and so forth seems to be, the fundamental result seems to be that these tidal devices are pretty benign to the fish. Are you finding something different or?
Not putting me on the spot there.
Well, I intended to. That's what you're here for.
so far, the work we did around a test device, we looked at fish responses really close to the device, and we did see a lot of fish able to avoid it. So we mostly saw mackerel size and smaller fish, and we saw fish swim up to it in a very high current and then swim away from it, and then schools of fish swimming around it. But we also saw small fish that went through it. Now we don't have, it's incredibly difficult from a technological perspective to capture that information in the high tidal currents that we're working under. So I couldn't say what happened to those small fish when they came out the other side necessarily. So we're trying to work on some of that as well. So when you say that they're benign to fish, we haven't quantified enough in terms of the small life stages and how the overall effect might be.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. We'll have more time for more questions on that too. Ryan, are you
sure? Yeah, I was going to introduce Daryl and then.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Hi, Daryl. Hi.
Hi, my name is Brian Hooker. I work for BOEM, as Paul mentioned earlier, but I'd like to introduce Daryl Francois. He's the chief of the project coordination branch in the Office of Renewable Energy at BOEM, and he's going to give a status update version.
We thought, after we're discussing things, we thought it'd be good to just give you a quick overview on what's going on across the entire Atlantic coast, and then Ryan has been working on some specific fishery best management practices in the entire region. But I just wanted to sort of give you a quick overview and update and to show you what's happening. I don't have a pointer, so I'm going to talk in terms of colors and states. And so if anyone's colorblind, raise your hand and I'll go from there. We were given this authority back in 2005 to regulate ocean renewable energy development offshore on the federal waters of the Outer Continental Shelf. And in 2009, we started a process of working with states up and down the coast to identify areas for leasing for wind energy development. And this is basically where we're at right now in beginning of 2013. If you start with at the very south, looking at North Carolina, we've issued what's called a call for information nominations, which is basically a request for information from the general public, as well as a way of gauging interest in leasing offshore. So the areas in purple that you see along the coast of North Carolina are, in working with the state of North Carolina and other federal agencies, we've identified as potential areas for wind energy leasing, and there's a call for information and nominations that is open until, it's been open for about 2 months now, and it closes at the end of the month. And after that, we'll have a better picture of how we're going to move forward offshore North Carolina. Offshore Virginia, we issued a proposed sale notice in December. That period is closed. We are looking at comments there. And a proposed sale notice is when we've gone past the information stage, the call people have, have there been enough interest by developers to indicate that there should be a competitive process for leasing. And we anticipate that there will be a lease sale for one lease, one wind energy lease for that area offshore, that sort of dark blue area offshore the coast of Virginia in 2013. Offshore the state of Maryland, we anticipate, we are close to issuing a proposed sale notice. We think we will be ready to do that about mid-year this year. And so we anticipate that sometime later this year, we will issue a final sale notice, and maybe in late 2013, early 2014, we'll have a lease sale. And the projection is for up to two leases for wind energy projects offshore the state of Maryland. Offshore the state of Delaware, we had a non-competitive process. When we went out for that call for information and nominations, there was only one developer that came in and said they were interested. So we went to a direct negotiation rather than having a lease sale. And we have negotiated a lease for the small yellowish orange area off the state of Delaware for one wind energy project there. Offshore New Jersey, we are similar to Maryland, we are close to issuing a proposed sale notice. Because of the size of the area, we anticipate that that could support anywhere from 3 to 5 wind energy projects. And so we have a project that we are working with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory right now to decide how to divide that area up into that 3 to 5 lease spaces, most so that we can have the most economically developable areas offshore the state of New Jersey. A little bit further north, we have an unsolicited lease from the New York Power Authority, a consortium with New York Power Authority, Long Island Power Authority, and Consolidated Edison for that sort of teal blue area that you see nestled in between those Coast Guard traffic separation schemes. Offshore in Long Island, and NYPA has proposed a project of anywhere from 350 to 1,000 megawatts in that area. We have a request for interest, a competitive interest, to determine if there are any other developers that would seek to develop in that area, so that we can determine whether there's competitive interest there. And so that nomination period closes at March 6th. For the offshore state of Rhode Island, we have issued a proposed sale notice there, and we anticipate that in 2013, we will have a competitive lease sale for up to two leases offshore the state of Rhode Island. Right next, immediately to the west of to the east of that, is a wind energy area that we've identified for the state of Massachusetts. We anticipate that late in 2013, there will be a proposed sale notice. We go from a proposed sale notice to a final sale notice. The proposed sale notices are open for a 60-day comment period, and then we gather that information and go to a final sale notice before having a lease sale. And we anticipate anywhere from up to 5 to 7 leases in that area. This is where we go from that area is significantly deeper. And you can, I guess one way of looking at this is the light blue along the coast there is basically the 30-meter depth contour. And so you can see that the Massachusetts wind energy area, all of it is outside the 30-meter depth contour. So that'll be a challenging development objective. And then right above that, you'll see the Cape Wind lease, which is the one of the two commercial leases we have there. And we anticipate to receive from Cape Wind later this year a facility design and installation report, which will, they have an approved construction and operations plan. They then will come in and give us the finer details of their project later this year, and then move to, they hope move to installation and operation in 2013 and after that. And then if you go further north, you'll get to where the Statoil project, the unsolicited proposal from Statoil for this pilot project of four turbines offshore the coast of Maine is cited. And we are currently looking and working with Statoil to see how we can move forward in that process. So that gives you just sort of a quick update of where we are. And then I'm going to turn it over to Brian, who will talk to you a little bit about his work with fishing.
Thanks, Darrell. So as Darrell mentioned, you know, we're just starting to get into the lease issuance phase where we anticipate we'll start actually receiving plans, whether it be site assessment plans or construction and operations plans. And in advance of starting to receive those project plans, the branch I'm in, the Environment Review Branch, also does environmental studies. We've launched a series of 8 workshops, which just concluded yesterday here in Maine, trying to really get into the best management practices that we will look for in those plans once they're submitted. Right now, we do have several best management practices related to fishing that are on the books that were published in 2007. We're just trying to refine those and try to get deeper into the details on what to actually look for when we receive those plans. For example, we have one of the best management practices is, you know, to coordinate and communicate and coordinate with fishermen. But that's obviously a very broad best management practice, so we'd like to flesh that out a little bit more to learn what that really should look like from fishermen in the different areas. So we've just concluded those 8 meetings from North Carolina to Maine. I also did want to just highlight quickly, we do get a lot of questions about what is our outreach on the European side. Just this week we held 2 workshops featuring Europeans. Both workshops looking at pile driving mitigation, not so much a concern in for floating turbine facility off of Maine, but most of the other facilities down the coast are likely going to have a fixed foundation with piles being driven. So, things to that could potentially mitigate noise impacts from fish and fisheries. And then also had 4 Europeans from the UK and the Netherlands talking about what they've seen on the ground so far as benthic habitat impacts. And both of those meetings and report outs from those meetings will be available on our website in the very near future. So, one other study that we do have ongoing is with the National Marine Fisheries Service Social Sciences Branch, looking at trying to establish a range of what the economic and social impacts might be to fishing from the installation of these facilities up and down the East Coast. So that's an ongoing study as well. But that's primarily it. I think we're here mostly to try to answer your questions when we get to that section. So thank you.
Again, they'll be around for more Q&A and discussion later. Any questions right now? Okay, next up is Jake Ward. Jake is Vice President for everything at the University of Maine. Is
that right? And no responsibility for a lot of things.
Okay, thanks again for having us here today, and I was hoping to, I was asked to give a quick update on our offshore wind program. So I'm just going to walk where we are right now is just a couple pictures to show you. We have over the last few years been gaining more program and our initial activity was a lot of that. Scale, and I'll talk a little bit about that, but just wanted to point out the 50th scale is the the picture on the left, and that's Habib Dagher, Pete Vigue, and Senator Collins. That is the model that we're looking at right now. It's a buoyancy-based model, and we'll be building the intermediate scale version of that. The turbine on the right is actually the turbine that will go on that intermediate scale. And that is currently, if you're in the Orono area, it's on a tower up on campus in the back of the lab. We're putting it through all its paces right now. So again, the whole concept of the offshore wind is really, can we generate clean power locally? Can we create economic opportunity by construction and operation and maintenance and all that good stuff? And also have a business that can sell that electricity to into the grid in a competitive way. So it's really targeting that can be fabricated in Maine for the most part, that can be locally managed, locally deployed, and at the same time, cost-effective electricity. We want to be competitive with whatever the market will bear at that time. So just the overall structure that we're looking at, just to point out some things that some people may not know. The buoyancy-based platform, so that's a floating platform tethered to the bottom with catenary cables. We're actually going forward with a concrete hull. We've looked at the different materials and different opportunities, and concrete lends itself to this environment as well as it can be manufactured locally and in many different places. We're looking at a composite tower. Composite tower is something a lot of standard turbines are using steel towers, but composites certainly have advantages in the marine environment, and are things that can be built locally. The blade manufacturing is another place that potentially, with a big enough project, there could be blade manufacturing done in Maine, though I would say at the early stages there's places that are already building that. The generator itself is probably not necessarily something that's going to be built in Maine anytime soon. But then you have also the opportunities for the servicing, the installation, and the deployment, and all those activities. So we're trying to have a whole comprehensive look at this as we go forward. So just to bring you up to date, the 2011-2012 was the couple of models. Up to this point, there was no computer simulation models available in public that looked at the floating platform and how it behaves in wind and waves, as well as a tower and turbine. Come up with a model where we can, through computer simulations, look at how to design, strength of materials, how they behave, all that type of stuff. We took land-based wind turbine models and offshore platform models and built a numerical computer simulation. We've then had testing of 50th scale, the small ones, and the wind wave basins, that data to validate the model. Over that time, we also looked at three distinct different turbine design, platform designs, the buoyancy, tension leg, and the spar. And so we've been working on that cost-benefit economic analysis, trying to get to, one, an overall cost of energy that is in the 10 to 15 cents a kilowatt hour, and at the same time, things that can be manufactured and installed in here. Over the last year, we've optimized that floating turbine design. We've ended up selecting that buoyancy base. And so we're right now in the process of building the intermediate scale turbine that is going to go in the water, hopefully in April. As you may have known in the past, when I talked about this, we were hoping to be in the water last summer for various assorted R&D reasons. That's always an interesting thing. We missed that deployment period, so we're shooting for this deployment period now. Again, the intermediate scale, smaller turbine, will actually go in the water. We'll build it and launch it in Brewer at Chimbrose facility and get towed down river. We'll hang out and get it all up and running, make sure all the systems work, understand how it performs, the data collection system and all that. And that will probably be in the April through June, early July time frame. And then at that point, it'll be towed out to the test site in Monhegan for through the end of the summer. Again, as a scale model, it's not meant to survive a main winter or even a main fall. So it's just meant to get the scale level waves and wind during that time period. And again, the all this work is leading to the prototype for the full scale, which is a 6 megawatt turbine that we call Volturnus. The scale model is 68 feet tall. I just wanted to make sure of it. So We currently have some DOE funding to now take this model and do the design of a full-scale 6-megawatt turbine. It's part of the DOE's pilot wind farm program. If we make it through this phase, through the design and get down selected, we'll have an opportunity to build a full-scale prototype 6-megawatt, which would go out into the Monhegan test site. Actually, our proposal will have two turbines for the pilot period. So that's the phase one of this next round of full scale, would be deployment of the 6-megawatt full scale turbine. And then phase two, 2017, would be the second turbine. So we'll get one out there. If it works, great. Then we can have the second one. Ultimately, the goal is to get to a commercial scale farm. It would be somewhere out in the Gulf of Maine. Probably out 10-15 miles offshore. We haven't any ideas what those locations would be yet. And then start building up to the point where the state of Maine's goal for the Ocean Energy Task Force was to get to 5 gigawatts of offshore wind. So this is really a crawl before you walk, before you run type of plan. So where we are with the New England Aquaventus one, Aquaventus refers to the farm itself. The next round of the competition is $93.2 million. That's the portion of that, around $50 million coming from DOE. The rest is for local match. We've put together a team of public, private sector companies, the Chimbros of the world, folks like that, to go out after that. We were selected as one of seven projects out of 70 that DOE looked at doing this pilot phase, and of course Statoil was another one, and you'll hear all about that soon. So, I mean, the amazing thing is that out of 70, two were picked for the Gulf of Maine, and it just goes a lot to say the quality of opportunity that's here and the level of commitment for everybody to try to make these things go forward. And so if we're successful at the down select, which is about a year from now, then we will have that funding available to build the full scale. And again, it's primarily to demonstrate and de-risk the technology and prove that we can get to that economic cost. And that's just some funny numbers, and it was good. So, anyways, I'll stop there. Thank you.